I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guests are master sommelier and winemaker Richard Betts and illustrator Wendy McNaughton. They're joined in conversation by Jordan Abel. And now join Jordan Abel on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Richard Betts and Wendy McNaughton.
Excited to see all of you here tonight. Thank you for coming for our whiskey tasting event with Richard Betts and Wendy McNaughton. Already applause. So the Essential Scratch and Sniff Guide to Becoming a Whiskey Know-It-All is one of my favorite book titles of all time. I've been so excited about this book ever since the first book in this of the Essential Scratch and Sniff Guide to Becoming a Wine Expert, which Richard and Wendy and Crystal wrote. It was a New York Times bestseller. It demystified the world of wine. And the team is back for an encore with this whiskey book. Richard is one of 13 people in the world to pass the Master Sommelier exam on his first try. And yes, his taste buds are on fleek, as the kids say. He has been featured in every major publication and on TV. He's the co-founder of Betts & Scholl Wines, Sombra Mezcal, and My Essential Wines. He's joined tonight by his co-author and one of my favorite people in all of San Francisco, Wendy McNaughton, who is also a best-selling author of Meanwhile in San Francisco, Pen and Ink, and with her partner Caroline Paul, Lost Cat, A True Story of Love, Desperation, and GPS Technology, which is also one of my favorite titles, an instant classic that's been translated into 7 languages, including most recently Romanian. They're also 2 of the nicest people, Richard and Wendy, that you ever could meet. So please join me to welcome Richard Betts and Wendy McNaughton.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
This is fun.
Hi.
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 Welcome.
Thank you.
Richard,
thanks.
Wendy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So, How should we start?
With a cheers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do that. So I know you were told to wait. Let's not wait. Go. upper left on this sheet, number one, is the Jameson Irish Whiskey. And we'd like to thank you for coming.
Yeah. Great to see all of you.
Cheers.
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 Yeah.
Cheers.
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 Oh.
Oh my God, there's Brian Berouche.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is good.
All right. Do you want to tell us about the Jameson or do you want to wait?
I'm going to wait.
Okay.
Let's keep him in suspense.
All right. We're keeping you in suspense. So I just wanted to start by asking what the genesis of this book is, but also of the idea of the sort of scratch and sniff board book format for an alcohol book.
Yeah, for a party book.
For a grown-up book.
Yeah, it's a kids book for adults.
Yeah.
And it came about in January of 2008, which is now a long time ago. But I was on a heli-ski trip with one of our friends. Mm-hmm. We had a really fun wine tasting and then a whole bunch of other extracurricular things. And we outlasted everybody. And we were chatting just about everything. You know, wine, life, how much fun it can be. And this is Chris Saka, and Chris says, hey man, how do we scale you? Like, how do we take what you just did for the 8 of us here tonight and, like, make it available to, you know, millions of people? I was like, I don't know, what do you think? He's like, write a book. It's like, yeah, but you know, like, wine books are, you know, they're this thick and they weigh 60 pounds and people buy them because they look nice, but no one reads them, and I don't think I have anything to contribute to that, you know, canon of literature, and you know, there's nothing new to say, really. And I have this, that's also not me, you know? I'm trying to invite people to the party, not make it hard or make it intimidating. You know, it's knock it off the pedestal. He's like, what about a scratch and sniff book? Like, that's genius. The next day, he left actually to Obama's first inauguration.
As you do.
No big deal.
From your heli-ski. Yeah.
Heli-ski, Obama.
Did he helicopter to the inauguration?
Helicopter to the small plane, to the bigger plane, to D.C.
As you do.
As one does, indeed. So I kept skiing, but marinated on it for a while and started working on it. And one thing led to another, and I needed help. And so I said, hey, Chris, I'd like to talk to your wife, Crystal, because I don't, you know, I can write the thing, but I don't know how to make it flow visually and tell that visual story. And so Crystal's an amazing art director, and she's like, yeah, I'm in. And she's like, and there's one person we need to work with, and she's to my left, Wendy.
My lucky day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All of our lucky days.
Yeah.
All of our lucky
yeah,
and days.
So you didn't know each other before?
No,
we didn't.
We'd never met before the Scratch and Sniff wine book. But what a great way to meet somebody
totally.
And start working together.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Crystal, for those of you who don't know, she's an art director. And what an art director does is kind of figure out like the concept and then also do layout and everything. And Crystal and I had worked together at an advertising agency back in the day. So she called me up and said, this would be really fun. We are good at coming up with ideas together. We're both really good at taking, I think, like big complicated ideas and reducing them down to simple things that, you know, even a 12-year-old could understand with a board book, for example.
Yeah.
And so we came up with some stuff, sat down with Richard and... Yeah, actually, we did it in how long? 4 days,
yeah,
I think.
4 days.
Yeah.
In Truckee.
In Truckee, we
hold
up in the.
It was summer.
Yeah.
No
it was
snow.
Summer, and we hold up in a house for 4 days, and Richard just spilled all of his knowledge out, and then Crystal and I were arranging stuff and figuring it all out, and then drawing on the spot, and we kind of created the whole first wine book right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
And were you? I mean, obviously you thought, like, we have a great book and proud of the book, but were you anticipating the wild popularity of it?
I think we all really believed in it. I mean, we paid for it ourselves. You know, we hadn't sold the book. And there's this thing where you can't publish unless you have an agent, and you can't get an agent unless you've published. So it's like, well, you know. But we believed in it, so we all leaned in and did it. And then... our agent sold it. He was actually really interesting. He's like, look, there are probably 5 people on the planet that can actually make this book. And I think it's a good idea, but, you know, be prepared for no one to accept it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a very good chance that people are like, you know, we haven't made these books since the 70s. So no. But Houghton Mifflin bought it, and which was great. And they've been a great partner. But everyone was still like, I don't know if this will work. So I think there was a little bet hedging, but we always believed in it.
Yeah.
And it's been exciting to be, you know, it's cool when you make stuff and you put it out in the universe, and then other people are like, oh, that's really cool. I'm going to enjoy that. It's a validation in a certain sense, and that matters. It feels good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the wine book mm-hmm. is out there. It's a mm-hmm. bestseller.
Yep.
And
that was really exciting.
What?
That was really exciting. Yeah.
I
mean,
it
was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, you have wine and you have Scratch and Sniff. It's like a good Venn diagram right in the middle.
Yes.
Bestseller. Yeah. It was really
exciting. In the middle
exciting.
Is that.
Yeah.
So then, you know, what did you always think, oh, we're going to do this for another drink or spirit or what? How did you go from wine to whiskey?
I mean, I think it's what are things, you know, hopefully our gift is to take something that's maybe well-loved but not well-understood and make it fun, make it easy to understand. So, you know, I use this example a lot. My 13th birthday dinner with my parents. They'd never really been to a nice restaurant. Went to the Palomino, and which is a very nice place in Tucson in the day. And I remember the first sommelier that I ever saw, and he was an old dude. He was scared my father and my mother, and he's in a tuxedo and had his little silver testa then. And that guy doesn't excite anybody about wine, right? You know, you look at him and you're like, oh my God. You know, so you retreat and you don't do anything. So we want to, you know, create the opposite situation where it feels really good. And so when you look around, like, what are other things that people love? What are other things that we can help disarm and make easy. And then I think the most important ingredient, once you've answered those two questions, is what does our methodology like apply itself to? You know, it's a great example of something that, and we'll get into the methodology in a second, but like it doesn't work with beer, for example, because there's no real sense of place with beer anymore. We can make a beer in Napa that tastes exactly like it was made in Ghent, Belgium, right? And so that's all changed. But whiskey, it really does work with.
Okay, and so how is your process, like how do you work together? I mean, you described, Wendy, 4 days, Richard just spilling out information and you're arranging it. Was that how it worked for whiskey book as well?
Yeah, really?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's really fun when you have a group of people who work together really well and to bounce off ideas, and it can happen really fast. But we did develop this kind of breakdown of things that it's the book runs as kind of an instruction, you know, breaking down the topic, whether it be wine or whiskey, and then culminates in this wheel that we'll talk about in a sec. But yeah, we did it pretty fast.
And had you, I mean, obviously you are a wine master.
Enthusiast, anyway.
Yes. Most enthusiasts pass the SOM exam on their first try, certainly.
Myopic?
So had you spent a lot of time with whiskey before the idea of the book? I mean, did you consider yourself?
For one day, I did. And it was...
You spent one day with it, or one day you considered yourself?
For one day previous this exploration, I considered myself to be knowledgeable in the subject. And that was the day I passed that test. You know, when you take a test, you know, you figure out how to beat the test, right? You don't... It's what it is. It's a game. And so when I took the Master Sommelier exam... that you cram everything and you figure out how to cram it all in so it all condenses and peaks at one moment, and as soon as you walk out of the exam, you start forgetting things. So that was in 2003, and then it was literally 10 years later that we started working on this book. And so I had to relearn all of it, which it sounds, I mean, I don't know how it sounds to you. To me, that's like a glass half full moment. Like, this is awesome. Wait a minute, we're going to get paid to relearn something about booze that I love and I'm excited about anyways? I mean, that's pretty cool.
Great. And Wendy, had you, before, you know, illustrating these books, had...
I had some whiskey before, yes.
Okay.
I knew that it was a topic that I was somewhat interested in.
Okay.
I would say that I don't... before both of these projects, wine and whiskey, I didn't know very much, but I had a sense maybe of what I kind of liked, more so with wine than with whiskey. And so it was fun for me to learn why I like what I like and to learn the process of what makes it taste that way, you know, so that now I feel like I can actually order something and it isn't just like a, you know... fingers crossed,
yeah.
I've heard somebody use this name before kind
of
thing.
Yeah.
So I have always been interested in the topic, and it was great to become more educated, Richard.
So given that, and this is a super complex, both of these topics are really complex, and you've distilled, in whiskey's case, distilled it into like a very concise 20 pages. So there's a lot of storytelling, and so I'm just wondering like how, Wendy, how you're thinking about the storytelling as you draw.
This is great. This is a good example of kind of two things. One is how a visual concept can convey something immediately, which might be a little bit more difficult to explain using words. And also, the way that I draw with pen and watercolor is, in general, kind of approachable, right? So whereas we could tackle it scientifically and talk about the process of actually making whiskey, you know, here's a way that we're showing it that feels like, you know, anybody can kind of understand this and enjoy it.
So, Richard, can you just very briefly talk us through?
So, the whole knock it off the pedestal, make it easy thing, that you figure out how to do that and then put it into 10 spreads, right? So you basically have 20 pages. So you got to get at it, you know, like cut to the quick pretty, you know, quickly.
So, right? And did you guys know this? That whiskey is just distilled beer? I just have to say that because I didn't know that.
It was like, what?
Yeah, total big epiphany moment.
That makes it super easy, right?
I know.
So this is it. When you make whiskey, it's just distilled beer. And 99 out of 100 people that I say that to, they're like, what? Like, yeah, you just take the Budweiser and you distill it. And distillation is just really, you reduce volume and you concentrate the part you want, which is, admittedly, you can all admit this too, you're here with us tonight, is the booze, right? That's what you're doing. You know, you're concentrating the booze, getting rid of the water and the other stuff. And so you start with a beer and you end up with something that's actually quite potent, but it also reflects, at this point, it reflects what you made the beer from, right? So there are two types of stills, the column or continuous still and the pot still. Some Carla, my fiance, and some friends and I spent last Thanksgiving on Islay in Scotland, and you see these amazing, huge copper stills, and I don't know, maybe three or four of them would fit in this room. They're really that big, and they're amazing, and when you run the beer through this thing, you have to do it twice. You put it through once, and you don't have the right strength of alcohol yet, so you put it through again, and then you get the right proof. But every time you touch it and you move it and the shape of the still, all these things contribute character to the spirit that comes out the other side. Whereas this thing is really, it supercharges the whole process and it makes it very, very uniform. And we tried to be very democratic in the book and say that they're equal. Because we're sitting here tonight, you know, I think, you know, if I like the intellectual value of wine, spirits, whatever. This stuff makes something really, really special. Not that this isn't good, but it all comes out the same, right? Every red is the same, whereas here red is pink, is kind of red-orange, so on and so forth. So that's step two after the beer.
Can I ask some, I'm not a whiskey expert question.
You can ask
questions.
Anything you
okay,
want.
So one, this beer thing. So are we talking about, like, are these whiskey makers making beer that then is only used to make whiskey? Like, is it actually beer, or are they getting?
Is someone taking
Guinness and putting whiskey into it?
They don't actually go all the way to the end of the beer. Although you can drink that stuff when you're there. Go to a distillery, ask to taste it. It's called the wort, W-R-T.
So wort is just almost finished beer.
Except it's warm and it's funky and it's got all the solids in it and
it's gross.
Yeah, it's kind of grody. It's kind of grody. We were at Bunahabin on the far corner of Islay, and they just dipped this little beaker in, or, you know, on this long chain in this huge vat. We could all fit in this vat and pull out this kind of steaming, foamy, yeasty beer, and like, here, have some.
What did it?
Tasted like a steaming, foamy, yeasty beer. It's kind of gross.
Okay.
You know.
Is there a way...
There's a reason we drink this stuff cold, right?
Okay. Yeah. And so we're all kind of in agreement. This pot still stuff is probably more expensive, is that...
It's for sure a more laborious process.
Okay. And now, is it always easy to tell, like, laborious, which process the whiskey... Like, if you're at the store, do you know?
No.
Look? Does it say?
You know, it happens... It's more about place. If it's pot stilled... in places where they don't typically pot still, they'll probably write it on the label, like in America or in Canada.
Okay.
But if it's Scotch, it's
always pot still.
Single malt, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Go. Well, let's talk about what goes in the beer, right?
Yeah.
Grain. That's how you make beer, right? So corn, wheat, rye. I wish you guys could scratch and sniff these things. Barley, which is frequently malted, and then the other stuff, everything else. Which Wendy's really beautifully illustrated there.
So each of these is you're going to be able to taste in the whiskey in a way you wouldn't necessarily in the beer?
Exactly. So if you it's the product of its ingredients. So if you start with corn, which has a sweetness and a mellow quality to it, the spirit that comes out of the still, and mind you, when it comes out of the still, it's white, it's clear. It doesn't have any color. Doesn't taste like the oak barrel that you're going to age it in or the place that we're going to talk about. It just tastes really like alcohol.
Is that moonshine? Is that what moonshine
mm-hmm.
is? Right.
Moonshine or White Dog or...
Okay.
Yeah, but moonshine could be, it can be anything. It could be peaches, it could be apples.
Ah, okay.
Could be sugar, you know, whatever you want to use in the backwoods of West Virginia.
But it's just the straight alcohol. Got it.
Yeah,
okay.
It is. Yeah. So whereas wheat's also quite mellow and soft, but not as sweet as corn... rye sticks out, and we're gonna come back to that. But rye is spicy, so you guys know what rye bread tastes like, right? It's spicy, right? It's pungent. It has some kick. So when you make beer out of that, it has that spice and that pungency, and that's interesting, right? And it's also deliberate. when you think about how do you want your finished product to look, and that finished product is a Rubik's Cube with like 1,000 sides, right? And our job in making this simple is to say, well, it only has 3 sides to start with, right? So which is grain, the first one you're looking at, and we'll talk about those in a second. But with this one, you know, whoever's making this stuff makes a deliberate decision and say, you know what, I want it to be really mellow, wheat. I want it to be sweet, corn. Or I want it to be spicier, I'm going to use more rye.
You're listening to Master Sommelier Richard Betts and illustrator Wendy McNaughton, whose new book is The Essential Scratch and Sniff Guide to Becoming a Whiskey Know-It-All. They're joined in conversation by Jordan Abel on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Or in the case of barley, you guys have all had a malted milkshake? Nobody?
Or a Whopper?
Yeah, a what? Or a Whopper. Exactly.
I know my dad has.
Whoppers are great.
Oh, you guys.
Yeah.
So that is what happens when you malt barley. So barley starts as a grain. And what does it mean to malt it? It means you sprout it. And just when it starts to sprout, you kill it. And the reason you kill it is because if you don't kill it, the sprout itself will eat all the sugar. The way you make alcohol is you add yeast to sugar, and it produces 2 things. Makes CO2, and it makes alcohol, right? And so it bubbles. That's the CO2 happening, and it makes alcohol. But if you let that sprout go too far, there's no sugar for the yeast to eat. So you stop it right at that moment. But one of the things you also capture at that moment is that malt flavor, right? And so when you make whiskey out of that, such as they do in Scotland, you really get an exaggerated malty character, which I personally find quite nice. But the whole point of the book is, we'll lay these out here for you, take a look at them, and you decide. I mean, that's the democracy of it. You know what? I hate malt. I threw up Whoppers when I was 5. Or, you know what? I love corn. Or I hate it. It gets stuck in my teeth. You'll all have different preferences. And so as you scratch and sniff your way through our book, you'll figure out what you prefer.
Cool.
Now, you know, the people use all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's quinoa whiskey, there's rice whiskey, there's all kinds of stuff.
So what makes something whiskey is this process of making gross beer,
yes,
and then distilling it into alcohol. Is that how you would define it? Like, how do you define?
That's the start.
And rice whiskey versus rice wine.
Well, you have to do it according to some set of laws.
Okay.
Like,
but who set the laws? Like a whiskey council?
Well, it depends where you are. So if you're in Scotland, there are a certain set of laws. If you're in Canada, there's basically one law, which is it just has to resemble Canadian whiskey. So do what you want. If you're in America, there's another set of very, very specific laws as well. But so wherever you are, if you adhere to those laws, then you're whiskey.
Okay.
Yeah, but this is just making the beer and distilling it, you're only halfway there.
Okay. What's next?
Next.
Wood.
Yeah.
I know you like this spread.
I do, yeah. It was fun to draw and interesting for me to learn about the next step that you're talking about, that it's this raw alcohol that then goes into some kind of wood and then it sucks the flavors from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So whiskey comes out white. How does it get brown? What happens when you bite an apple or you cut an avocado and you leave it on the counter? Oxidation turns brown, right? So it's turning brown due to that, but it's also turning brown because you put it in a barrel, which is also brown. And you're creating essentially a beer-based tincture of whatever oak you put it in, right? So that's the second of 3 pieces. The first is the grain, and then the next flavor you're going to add to this thing is the flavor of the wood. So it, you know, you're putting in there, you know, maybe it's 100 proof, 50% alcohol spirit you're going to put in this barrel. It's going to start to take the flavors from it. And if you're going to make whiskey in America, well, it has to go in a new charred American oak barrel or it's not whiskey. You don't get to play, right? It has to be that. And so it's going to, when you put it in that barrel, that new charred American barrel, it's going to extract flavors of cinnamon and vanilla and brown spices and some smoke and the char and, you know, all that sort of French toasty stuff. The other thing you can do is be in another part of the world and use barrels. So if you're in Scotland, you might use these barrels, the New American Oak barrels, after Jack Daniel's is done with them, for example. So they use them. They need to make more whiskey. They need new barrels. What do they do with the old barrels? Well, they're actually really in demand. They sell them to tequila makers. They sell them to all kinds of people. Yeah.
So American whiskey is always in new barrels?
Yep.
It's like such a...
If you're going to be bourbon,
about America, right? We have to always use the new barrels, and then we send them somewhere else when we're done with them.
Totally.
Okay.
And in terms of an oak flavor, it's also very American, which is it just screams, right? It just has so much of it. I use this analogy. I use it with wine too. The difference between Old World and New World is almost like the difference between going to the cinema and going to the movies. And here we go to the movies and it goes bang, right? And in the first 30 seconds, you know what's going to happen in the remaining 89 minutes. And it's just loud and brash. Mm-hmm. And then when you go to the cinema, it twists and turns. And 2.5 hours later, just when you think you know where it's going, it goes somewhere totally different. And there's a subtlety to it and a complexity and an elegance. And I think you can hear my voice, which one I prefer, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah, it is rather American. So, but if you're in Scotland or you're in Japan, you might use the barrels after Jack Daniel's, for example, uses them, and then just has less to say, right? Something got extracted from it, so it's taken some of that new oak, but it has a little bit less of it to give, but it also has the flavor of the whiskey itself to give, right? Because the wood soaks it up. So it actually has some of the flavor of the Jack Daniel's to share with it, which is kind of interesting. You might choose to use barrels from sherry in Spain. And so there you'll taste things like hazelnuts and dried fruits and these sorts of things. So the point is that if you're a whiskey maker, you get to choose. But the real point is if you're a whiskey drinker, you get to choose. And so as you work your way through it, we've tried to illustrate for you, like, here are the flavors you might encounter in different whiskeys and decide which ones you like, right? So now... I use this analogy where we are essentially dissecting a frog.
You're dissecting a whiskey frog.
We are dissecting. But so the deal is you dissect a thing, you cut it open, like, oh, there's the heart, there's the spleen, there are the lungs, that's the liver, there's the appendix. And you pull them all out and you look at them. Yeah. But unlike the frog, you get to pick the pieces you want, put them back in, sew it up, and make exactly the frog you want. You know, you can leave the lungs out.
Frog, like a little.
Exactly, okay. Yes. Just like that. And so that's this process. That's what we're trying to do here is dissect it for you to then decide. And what you make the beer out of, your ingredient list, is called your mash bill, right? And so what's going to go into the mash? Well, if you're going to make bourbon, it has to be at least 51% corn. But the balance is up to you. So there's one here, the Cirrus Noble,
yeah,
San Francisco whiskey, which is actually, I believe it's 75% corn. But in the balance, it actually has a very heavy percentage of rye. So they consider themselves to be a rye bourbon, if you will. So it's a little bit spicier, despite all the corn content. So everyone plays with that, right? So that's back to that thousand-sided Rubik's Cube. Like, what do you want to do?
Can we taste
that?
We
should,
yeah, let's taste it. Let's do it.
So we're trying number 3. We're already going out of order.
Before we go to the third and last piece, do you have a question?
Yes. So, yeah, the question was,
thank you.
Why is it that bourbon has to be made in Kentucky?
Kentucky.
And the answer is...
You know, a lot of it's made in Indiana these days. So I think it's all changing. So, for example, there are all these class action lawsuits where people have claimed it's handcrafted or state-made or so on and so forth, but most of it comes from Lawrenceburg, in a place called LDI, where they make all kinds of food additives, and they're great distillers. They have a whole lot of those continuous stills. But there was a period in time when it had to actually be from Bourbon County and then Kentucky, but now it's wide open to do what you want. However, that's both exciting, like the craft beer thing. It's very exciting because there's so much diversity. But it's also a little dangerous because just because we can make it everywhere doesn't mean it's all going to be good. That's a thing. Craft doesn't equal quality necessarily.
Okay, so we've got all the different grains.
Yes.
Adding to flavor, and then we've got the wood. So what's next?
Place. Place matters. So when was the last time you were in a restaurant where you could smoke?
Actually, just 2 weeks ago.
What country were you in?
But we were in Romania. My partner in Romania, and it was actually incredibly disgusting. I didn't remember how really terrible it is. It was like walking into a wall of smoke, and within a couple minutes, I got pretty nauseous and actually had to get up and leave. And then we probably stayed for, what, maybe 30, 45 minutes or something like that. And we walked out. We took the restaurant and all of those wonderful cigarettes with us in our clothes. It stuck there for a very long time.
Right. We've all had this happen, yes?
Yeah.
The point of mentioning this is to say that place matters. You know, you're in a restaurant for 35 minutes or 2 hours or whatever it is, and you start to smell like that place. And when you are whiskey, you come out of the still, you got the grain factor. We put you in a wood barrel, so now you're going to have the wood factor. But where you put that barrel matters a ton. If we put you by the seaside in Scotland, you're going to start to smell like the ocean, right? If we put you in Kentucky, you are going to start to smell like Kentucky, but there's a different set of circumstances at work there, really meaning this hot and cold thing, right? So it gets very, very, very hot in the summer, and you might be a barrel in the attic of a warehouse that just, it's hot. It's really, really hot. So what that does is it doesn't so much make you smell like the cornfields around. It makes the process, all the processes speed up, so the aging happens more quickly, the extraction from the oak happens more quickly, and the volume gets turned all the way up really on the first two parts of the process. So where that barrel sits is huge, and it matters a lot. When you get through the book, you decide, you know what, do I like the iodine and the brine and the salt of the Scottish seaside, or does it remind me of Band-Aids and the nurse's office in sixth grade? And I hate that, right? You're all going to decide that for yourselves. And then you, again, put back together your frog with the pieces you want or you don't.
Cool.
Yeah.
So what are there? Is there like a word that you could use to describe, or a few words for each country? Like.
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to take that one?
I could be wrong, but when I think of American whiskey based on our experience, I think of something that's a kind of rounder. Is that right?
Yes, totally.
excuse me. Yeah, a bit fuller and rounder. When I think of, give me another one, Scottish whiskey.
Yep.
What I get, and maybe this is a question for you, what I think of is the peatiness.
Yep.
There's this, and you know, this is embarrassing to admit, but I didn't really know what peat was until doing this. You know, you dig it out of the ground, right?
Yeah.
And so how does this question for you, so is it because the barrels are just in a peaty environment that it gets that?
That's a great question. So remember the part where we sprout the barley and then we kill the sprout?
Yeah.
We kill it with a fire made from peat.
Oh, so yeah. It's like a fire in the smoke of that.
Yeah, it's almost like imagine a building with two floors, except the top one's perforated, and up here the sprouts are living, and down here you build the fire, and the smoke and the heat flows up through it, kills it, but it also flavors it.
Nice.
Yeah. So it distills your jacket after being in that smoky restaurant.
So yeah, the peatiness for Scotland, for Japanese whiskey, okay.
Yes.
So, okay, Japanese whiskey. So I had heard that Japanese whiskey was like the best whiskey, that it was the most expensive whiskey, which I also thought meant the best whiskey. And I really wanted to like it. So I, you know, tried it, and I think you probably brought a really good bottle, probably better than I'll ever have again. Yeah. And I took a little sip of it, and it's disgusting. I'm sorry. It tastes like drinking like iodine, or not iodine, it's like astringent.
Yep.
It's like a rubbing alcohol or something. So perhaps I don't have like the sophisticated nose.
It's not about sophistication.
It's not?
No.
It's about practice?
It's, what? About, it's about preference.
It's about preference.
Yeah.
So Japanese whiskey, astringent, I think that's probably not fair. So more like incense, that's what I've learned,
exactly.
Right? There's more kind of...
subtle.
Yeah. Ireland, help me out here, I think a little bit sweeter.
Yeah, honey, grass, honey. It doesn't really have a lot to say, right?
Yeah.
Typically that's distilled a little bit more, so maybe three times or what have you. And every time you distill, you take something away.
Right.
Right, and they don't typically use peat, so you're not adding anything else. So You know, if you keep distilling, you just get vodka, right? It tastes like nothing. Because every time you put something through a still, you end up with just more and more concentrated alcohol, and the flavor gets left behind.
Right, and it's kind of the same thing with Canadian whiskey, right?
It is.
Which is the other place, and it's kind of sad because there's actually a Macnaughton whiskey that's the Canadian whiskey, and from what I understand, it's kind of flavorless. And it's unfortunately not very good. But in general, I think Canadian whiskey is mellow.
Let's
say
mellow.
Very mellow.
Maple.
Drinkable.
It's Canada.
Very easy drinking.
Easy drinking.
It's relaxed.
Like,
it's young
like
and good
Canada.
Looking.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like
easy. Just like Canada.
And making all kinds of...
Totally. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so we have grain, wood,
and we have place.
Yeah.
Then you get to put them back together.
Okay.
Let's do that. Let's taste before we keep going with the slides. So grain, wood, and place inform everything you're going to drink. You've already had some number one. Let's have a little bit more.
So number one is this Jameson's Irish.
Ideally, yes. We're going to sort of build in flavor as we walk through this tasting, right? So I think this is pretty typical of what Irish whiskey is about. It's actually why Jameson is like a 2 million case brand or something like this. Because it's easy to drink and people chase it with pickle juice, which I would encourage you to never do. It's called a pickleback. Always say no. Oh
so God. This bottle also boasts triple distilled. And now we know what that means.
Now we know what that means. Exactly. So taste it, sip it. And I'm curious who loves it and who loves it? One, two.
Like loves. Like love. Yes. Okay, big heart coming from the marketing table.
Wow. But it's pretty easy. It's pretty easy, right? It's sweet and just like us. Yeah. So, yes?
What does a blend mean? Of grains?
Of grains and barrels.
Everything.
And it's just a big, make it the same thing every time.
So this one tastes the same in every bottle.
It does. Yeah. And you know what? That's one of the interesting things about spirits is that once you decide you like Jameson or Jamo or whatever you call it, it's going to be the same thing every time. So the whiskey maker actually, this is really interesting. Can I tangent for a minute? Everyone thinks like craft is better, and I'm all for it. I'm a craft distiller myself, but craft does not necessarily mean better. The way that they can make this the same every time is having the expertise to do it and being able to make enough different barrels that age in different places. And then this is where the real magic happens. Like somebody with a big nose like me sits and puts all the pieces back together to assemble the exact same thing every time.
That sounds really hard.
It sounds super hard.
Really hard.
Yeah, it is hard.
All right.
Okay, so let's add a little bit more character. Let's come across the Atlantic and drink number two. So bourbon, right? So you went from old barrels, triple distilled, to probably column distilled, matters not, but aged in new barrels and aged in there for 10 years, right? And in that warm place again. So pick it up and drink with me. Okay, so do you guys feel this? Do you feel the big difference in the pickup of those brown spices, the vanilla, the sweet elements? That's the barrel.
Good.
So now you know, you can just tap into that and say like, okay, now I know what a new barrel tastes like, and this is really it, right? And so the key with the time, the 10-year part, is that it's A, extracted a lot from the barrel, but B, it takes on a patina, right? And it gets softer and gets easier to drink, which is important.
Once it's in the bottle, does it change with age, the way wine would?
That's a great question. Yeah, largely no. Like, almost not at all. So we, a couple weeks ago, we got together with some friends down south and drank a bunch of very, very old whiskey that hadn't been cracked hadn't been cracked at all, and they were from the 40s. And there was some evaporation just because the seal isn't perfect. So for sure, something's happening. But really, one of the cool things about tasting those old spirits is you get a real snapshot of what distillation was like at that time. So I'm actually a freak for really old Calvados, things from the 1800s. I love them. And I love them because it's a glimpse back, and they did things differently, and they're a little rougher, and the buzz is different, so on and so forth. But, you know, the long answer to your question is essentially they are as they are. Yeah, unlike wine.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features master sommelier Richard Betts and illustrator Wendy McNaughton, whose new book is The Essential Scratch and Sniff Guide to Becoming a Whiskey Know-It-All. They're joined in conversation by Jordan Abel. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I love this question. The question is, once you open a bottle of whiskey, does the clock start ticking? A clock starts ticking, and the analogy was also made, is it like a bottle of wine? I love that question because I love to stump about you, which is the apogee of any wine is intensely personal. I love old wine. I know lots of people that like the same wines really, really young. In fact, I have one guy, a friend, he collects a bunch of very fancy Burgundy. He drinks it all really young. I like it really, really old, so we're always at odds about that. But we're both right. It's whatever makes you happy, right? It's just like choosing your own flavor of toothpaste or when you go to the ballot box. Everybody's right for themselves. The thing about whiskey is the clock doesn't tick as quickly as it does with wine. But it definitely ticks. So Carla and I, last summer, we blind tasted for this book more than 500 whiskeys. We had more than 300 of them on the floor of our apartment. You could barely walk.
Were you on the floor of your apartment?
There were days when we were both definitely on the floor of the apartment.
You guys really did suffer for all of us.
We did.
Thank you.
We did suffer, but we're here. And so what we found, we read one book in particular that said, look, you open a bottle of whiskey, you got to drink it a week. And that's just not happening. Not when you have 300 of them, you know, maybe 7 or 8. But what we did find is that they do change. And as only, you know, in the last couple months, we've gone back to retaste some of these things that we opened a year ago. And we're like, wow, we didn't like it then. We really like it now. It really has evolved. It's not profoundly different. It's not like the Chardonnay goes flat and turns brown. But something changes. And in our case, it was for the better. Like, well, actually, I want to keep that and drink it. When you're like, you know, going through it all, like, what am I going to give away? Or, you know, Boxing Day moment. That's one of the benefits of living near us. We're always giving booze away. I would say it's really up to you, you know? So decide what feels right. We'll talk about some of the language of the label. And when you walk in the store, this is why everybody works so hard on this. Most things are bought based on what you see or what you read. You know, small batch, non-chill filtered, family-owned, whatever claim they may want to make, you know, that carries a lot of weight. So people do all kinds of things with labels to make you buy them, and there's no legal definition of small batch whatsoever.
So can we also, I just noticed the Jameson was 80 proof and the bourbon is 90 proof. And
exactly.
Things are kind of different. Is there a general range that most whiskeys are? Is it like that 80 to 90 range?
I like that question too. Why are things 80 proof in the first place? And I should mention proof is a measure of alcoholic strength that equates to exactly 2 times the actual percentage. So if it's 40% alcohol, it's 80 proof. Why are things 80 proof? It's because that's where the tax advantage is. So, again, as a guy that distills and moves liquor around, the higher the proof, the more tax you pay. And so, for some reason, we've all settled on this 80 proof thing, or some people have, and we've accepted it as consumers. So people are like, well, why wouldn't I water it down? So, you know, water is basically free, at least right now, unless you're in California. So you add that to the whiskey and you essentially stretch it and you pay less tax. That doesn't mean it's the place where it tastes best. And every company, every distiller makes that determination for themselves. So I think when you get into more serious whiskeys that ask more of you as a drinker, they're almost never 80 proof. They're always higher because, you know, someone's like, okay, that's it. That's my thing. Stop right there. And
are there examples where there's something that's very high proof that's going to be like,
well, is it going to be, that's up to you. I mean, I like those things.
What I'm trying to do in case, I want things that I can go into the liquor store when I don't know anything and be like, here are all of my options. All of these are within $50 or whatever I've decided I'm going to spend, and then how do I know what the best, and I know it's all preference, but like what are little signs that like this one's just marketing and it's like not very good, or you know, this one's really special.
I wrote a book for you.
Did you?
This is how you do it.
Okay.
I mean the first thing is to determine really what's your profile, right? And you read the book, you scratch the sniff, you reassemble your frog, but then you know, like, okay, I want to drink something from the Scottish Isles. Well, this is I think a really important thing for all of us to get over or get on board with, and it's changing a relationship. And it's a transactional one, so it tends to feel adversarial as opposed to something else. But develop a relationship with a store. Like Cask is a great store in San Francisco. BevMo can be a great store. I mean, the people in those stores know a lot. So the idea is you know, treat them, you know, develop a relationship and say, hey, Richard, you know what? I got $20 in my pocket and I want something from the Scottish Isles. What do you have for me? And 99% of the time, you're going to get someone that's actually genuinely interested in their job. I mean, they're working in a liquor store. I mean, they've probably made a lifestyle choice because, and I don't mean that, it's not a pejorative thing. It's a real thing. Like, they like the stuff and they want, their enthusiasm just boils over and they want to share it with you. And so when you start to see that person as your advocate and not as your adversary, I think you're gonna do well. So trust those people, you know, be it your sommelier or person in the liquor store.
Okay.
Yeah.
So can we take a little sidetrack to talk about dilution, like serving things neat versus over ice or with water?
Let's do that.
Okay.
So when Carla and I tasted all of those 500 whiskeys last year, I think we haven't gotten over ourselves in this capacity. We really pride ourselves on being purists, and we're like, okay, taste them neat, meaning straight. Like, don't add anything to it. Do it. And it's important to do that academically. But then we couldn't get over this idea of adding water to something. And then we were very embarrassed when we found that some things are really a whole lot more interesting when you add some water. In particular was Wendy's Japanese whiskey. So maybe when she adds water, she'll like it. And definitely experiment. So make sure you taste it without anything added to it. And then do it like this. Like literally stick your finger in your water glass and then drop it in there, like a couple drops off your finger, and it will change. It's remarkable. And so what we found and was really, you know, humbling and enlightening and a very nice lesson is that some of these things really do blossom with water. And I had a great question that I was totally, had not thought about in advance. It happened at Omnivore Books the other night. I got the question, you know, why does that happen? And as a scientist, former geologist, like, I'm always into that data, not dogma thing. I was, you know, in that half second you go over it all, I was like, gosh, I don't know. And then started talking about it. I was like, well, actually, I do know. And I did this, right? You can see I've 10 fingers, but you can't make them out individually. But you increase the interstices, the space between them, such as we would do with water, and now you can see them all, right? And you can see them more clearly. And it's really the same thing. When you add water to these whiskeys, they just expand, and you're able to say, oh, there's that piece, and oh, I really like that, and I really like that floral part, and oh, there's the peat, and there's a minerally thing I never saw before. And that's pretty interesting. Doesn't mean you like it better. You may like it less. But when you have a free swing at it, like right now, you might as well play and see what works for you.
And then what about ice? I mean, that's obviously...
So ice is another a big thing that... You do this and you do this simultaneously.
So
you
giant
do,
ice cubes that are
So the big ice cube, it's a surface area issue. So you actually have less surface area on a single ice cube than you do many. So it melts more slowly, preserves temperature. So when you add water, it does this. But when you cool something down, all reactions proceed much, much more slowly. So you almost close it up simultaneously. So I use ice personally to mediate the alcohol. And I don't mean like my intake of it. I mean, sometimes there's a burn because, I mean, look, it's high proof. So you can use the temperature to mediate that burn a little bit, and a little bit of water opens it up. But very frequently at home, we have one of those really cool ice cube gravity machines that make these big balls. we'll put it in there, and invariably it comes out a couple minutes later, and you just throw it away because it gets to where you want it to be.
Okay. So you put the ice in and then remove.
I do.
You do. All right. That's like a hot tip.
Yes.
Right? Does anyone have other questions right now? Yes, in the front. Sorry.
Single malt versus blended, what's the difference? Oh, what do I prefer? This is a great question. So if you're a blended Scotch whiskey, in today's climate, you're somewhat looked down upon, right? It's somehow less good. I have no idea how we got to that idea. Single malt meaning it's made from single moment of malted barley. And why is that better? You know, I don't know that it is better. Sometimes you make things that are more complex by blending. Like an orchestra is composed of many performers, right? So I think that the same proves true with whiskey. But whiskey simultaneously lives up to our myth and defies it. And so there's plenty of blended whiskey that's just lousy. And then there's plenty of it that's actually really, really good. And when we did all the tastings for this book, we did them blind, right? So I don't mean like this, but we didn't know what was in the glasses. And we found that a lot of blended scotch in particular is really good. It's pretty cool. So that's why you need this. It decodes it for you. One of the spreads that I'm most excited about in the book, it's the language of the label. And so consistent with knocking it off the pedestal and empowering you to make good decisions, we want to talk about all the things that you'll see on a label, including things like cask strength. Like, well, what does that mean? You know, and we talk about it. It doesn't mean you should buy it, but in that case, it means that it's the alcoholic strength that it was when it came out of the cask, and they bottled it as such, as opposed to adding water and bringing it down to 80 proof, for example. Age statements. You know, if it talks about being 12 years old, well, it's at least 12 years old. If it doesn't, you have no idea how old it is, but I think the one thing pertinent to that is we want to say that it doesn't, older is not necessarily better, right? And we can say that both objectively and subjectively. Whatever is better is up to you. Objectively, we can say that as whiskey gets older in Kentucky, where it's hot and it's about that place, and the reaction proceeds very, very quickly, you go from something that's not drinkable to something that is drinkable to something that's maybe a little bit more delicious and mellow to something that then again becomes undrinkable because it extracts so much from the oak. It actually, tannins are when you bite, you leave the tea bag in the tea too long, or you bite the banana peel to get it open, right? And those things that dry out your mouth. Oak has lots of those. And if you leave it in the barrel for too long, you're going to extract enough of that that it actually becomes undrinkable. Things like bottled in bond, that's right up there with the small batch bit. But it's put on bottles to look fancy and look interesting and create allure and like, oh, well, it must be interesting, it must be special. It doesn't mean anything other than it was government regulated in a different and more specific way, which has almost no bearing on reality these days. But it looks fancy when you put it on a bottle. And then my favorite is, it says non-chill filtered. And, you know, if you relate that to wine, we talk about unfined, unfiltered, and that's somehow better. And the whiskey people have taken a page out of the wine marketing people's book, and they put this on the bottles now. It says non-chill filtered. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means they didn't chill it and filter it. But does that make it better? It's hard to say. You know, again, that's really up to you. The point is to say that just because it's on the bottle doesn't mean it's great. And start to disarm some of these terms that are really meant to, I think, obfuscate and make you think it's better than it is.
So armed with your book.
So armed with your book, now you know how things, what things to be aware of on the label, and you know what you like in the way of grain and wood and place. And then we created this thing, which is in the back of the book, and this is a choose your own adventure map that I couldn't be more excited about. The one that Wendy and I and Crystal made for the wine book is for sure the coolest thing I've ever been a part of making. It's really gratifying to think that we can boil something down to three questions, pose them to you, give you the answers, which are, you know, unique to you, and then you ask these three questions. You know, how do you like your grain? Well, if you say, hey, I like the malt and the cookie dough, you're going to go this direction. If you say, you know what, I love that Seinfeld episode and I'm all about the marble rye, you're going to go this direction, right? And whatever it is, you just answer this for yourself, and you head in this direction. And then you get to the next question, which is the wood question. And do you want it to be big and rich and toasty like the Russell's Reserve? Or do you want it to be more, you know, subtle, much like the Hakushu was? And you answer that question and you go whichever direction it takes you. It bifurcates or trifurcates. And then you get to the last one, which is the place question, right? And so once you answer all these things, you end up in a thing, in a place like Irish whiskey, and you're like, okay, so Irish whiskey's for me. And in wine, it would take you to a place generally. If you said, I like red fruits, I like oak, I like American oak, and I like it funky, that would lead you to a place called Rioja, and we would generally recommend Rioja. But because wine changes every vintage, thanks to Mother Nature, we can't say, drink Cune Rioja, because Cune Rioja is different every time. I mean, it generally satisfies those three requirements, but every vintage has something slightly different to say. The thing with spirits is once you become a Lafroig drinker, which I anticipate happening at some point, you're gonna want Lafroig to taste the same way every single time. And while that's just different and unique to spirits, it also lets us take our work one step further and actually recommend specific things. And so if you find your way here, and this, let's just use bourbon and Tennessee whiskey in this area, well, there are about 50 whiskeys we recommend here. And if you follow the color gradation, it goes from much lighter to much darker, and that corresponds to the way we recommend these things. And so at the very, very beginning, you have Seagram 7, Early Times, Old Granddad. These are things that we say you can mix or shoot, and they're not going to require much of us. But we can drink them and continue on our conversation, and it's you know, it's fine. If you go all the way through the mix and sip to the sip and savor part, this is probably something that you're not going to mix with Coke and throw back, and you're going to find things there like Pappy Van Winkle, 23-year, William LaRue Weller, George T. Stagg, and yes, you can shoot those things, but they will actually physiologically grab a hold of you and say, pay attention to me. Mm. And that's what we've tried to do here is say, it requires more and more of your attention as you go right. And if you want to tune into that and you want to give it your attention, then do so. And if you don't, you know, stay back left. And to the point of price, I wanted to go back to that Hakushu, which while it was the most expensive thing on the table, if you look here, we didn't give any indication of price. But the genius of this map is that you can go left or right and find something that's probably, I mean, at least in our esteem, when Carla and I tasted all these things, it's as good, but may cost, you know, a number completely different. And so where the Hakushu 12-year sits at $100, it actually sits between Hibiki 17-year and Hibiki 21-year, which are both a multiple above the Hakushu 12. So if you're like, you know what, I really wanted that Hibiki, well, go to the right and get something that's like 1 degree more serious and half the price. And so that's what we've tried to create here is you take, work your way through the book, figure out what makes your heart tick, and then answer the three questions, and there you go.
Yeah. Thank you.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Guys. That was really fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were master sommelier and winemaker Richard Betts and illustrator Wendy McNaughton, whose new book is The Essential Scratch and Sniff Guide to Becoming a Whiskey Know-It-All. They were joined in conversation by Jordan Abel. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.